This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the Supreme Court will be addressing the constitutionality of sentencing children to imprisonment for life without parole.
It's hard to believe it's taken this long to get that case to the Supreme Court. This is one of the more disgusting practices of this country.
We'll talk about the disturbing case in which an activist was arrested at the G20 summit for twittering.
Since when is twittering public information a crime? Well, let's hope this case is beaten.
We'll talk with attorney Joel Kufferman about what he saw at the G20 protests in Pittsburgh.
The first time in this country, long-range acoustical devices were used to disperse demonstrators. Another new level of repression.
Stay with us.
Michael, I'm holding in my hand this hipster magazine called Elle Magazine, and the front cover has got a big red and white thing that says Heroes and Villains, and guess who's a hero?
I can't imagine. Our own Heidi Boghossian,
yep.
A hero?
And you know why?
To the New York City Police Department?
No.
What's it for, Michael?
Well, because she heads up a band of National Lawyers Guild observers who wear ugly colored green hats and make sure the cops don't mess over protesters. And if they do, they, in the words of Elle Magazine, Heidi bears witness.
I won't read you the whole entry about Heidi, but it ends with saying, Heidi Boghossian, a former newspaper editor. What newspaper, Heidi?
The East Villager.
And tireless progressive, that we know, fighting her ass off for social justice from Lower Manhattan.
Okay, Heidi.
Congratulations, Heidi. Any comments?
I'm very flattered to be included in this wonderful group of activists and others.
Have a lot of people recognized you on the street because of this?
Not yet. Let's hope.
But it actually is a great role because as the police state has gotten more and more repressive, what Heidi and the National Lawyers Guild have done have been out at those street protests and both here in New York and around the country at the various conventions, etc. So it is true that Heidi is a real hero, and that's why both begin with H, Heidi and hero.
Thank you.
And I'd like now to have a discussion about the back cover.
The back cover? We'll forget about the back cover. We have a real hero with us, so I want all our listeners to know, if you ever get in trouble, call the National Lawyers Guild in New York or nationally, and Heidi will occasionally pick up the phone. Heidi, congratulations again.
Thank you.
October 9th marked the 42nd anniversary of the American murder of Che Guevara. It's a hidden history, and we're working on documenting it and bringing it out as soon as possible on the CIA and the American government's responsibility for the murder. Michael, what are your thoughts on Che's 42nd anniversary of his murder?
Well, he's still an icon and a hero to much, much of the world, particularly those struggling for social justice. And I think despite the efforts of the, particularly the capitalist countries, the imperialist countries, to try and denigrate his image and to denigrate him, he's emerged actually stronger than ever. And I do have just the whole speech in front of me, but I have the excerpt from a speech that Fidel gave on October 19th, which was right after it was acknowledged by the Cubans that Che was murdered on October 9th. And I'll just read a couple of lines. This is Fidel. Che did not fall defending any interest, defending any cause other than the cause of the exploited and the oppressed in this continent. Che did not fall defending any cause other than the cause of the poor, the humble of this land. And the exemplary manner and the selfishness with which he defended that cause is not even debated by his greatest enemies. So I think that's really probably the best testament we can have to Che Guevara, is that he died fighting for the cause of the poor, the social justice, and in favor, really, of those who have been cut out of any of the privileges and goods of our society.
We're working on a hidden history. Michael, through a Freedom of Information Act request, got the documents that definitively demonstrate that the United States was behind the murder of Che, the CIA and the executive branch in the White House and the Green Berets who trained the murderers. They did everything except pull the trigger. We're coming out with the book hopefully next spring. I'm not sure what it's going to be called. We're toying with the idea of calling it Murdering Che, The Hidden History, but we don't know yet. All we know is that it's going to be out. We'll be having more discussions on it and try to get it out to our listeners.
No, I've actually really enjoyed working on it with you, Michael. You know, going back and looking at the documents and looking at all the biographies, you know, it's like you immerse yourself, and it's if you're actually there at the time in a way. It's an exciting project and one in which we'll really lay the murder of Che, and that's what it was, at the foot of the United States.
Yeah, I think that Che's murder at the hands of the American government is generally an accepted truth around the world, but not so much here. And that's why it's a hidden history. And that's why I think it's important to put another nail in the coffin of this government and that lie.
Michael, we've spoken earlier about the case of Abu Omar, who was kidnapped from the streets of Italy, literally. What's happening in that case?
Kidnapped literally, as we've told our listeners before, by some 26 CIA agents, along with Italian intelligence and who knows who else. And there's tremendous opposition to trying those agents in Italy. They're not in Italy any longer. But both the Italian government and the U.S. is very upset that some independent Italian prosecutors have been actually going forward with a trial. The trial has been going on for 2.5 years now. The kidnapping took place in broad daylight in February 2003. The trial's been going on for 2.5 years, and the main prosecutor, Armando Spataro, who I've met in Europe at various occasions, sends out periodic updates. And the one we got a few days ago is actually quite exciting. The prosecutor is doing his summation now, and he's asked that the 26 Americans be sentenced to jail terms ranging from 10 to 13 years. 10 years is the normal for official kidnapping, unless there's aggravating circumstances. But in any case, 10 to 13 years, the trial's going on in Milan. And what Armando Spataro said in his closing statement, apart from asking for the sentencing of these 26 CIA agents, is that even in times of terrorism, he essentially says, we don't have an alternative but to have absolute respect for the law, even where it seems difficult. Only this will give us credibility. And that's from Armando Spataro's closing statement. So we'll see whether they get convicted, which I think is certainly very possible, and what kind of sentences get imposed. And then the big question is whether the fine Italian right-wing government of Berlusconi will actually ask for their extradition from the United States. There is a list appended to the emails we've been getting that lists 28 people, including a couple of Italians on here, but 26 CIA agents. I don't know whether they're real names or not. There may be the aliases. And, of course, as people know, Armando Spataro, when he comes here and speaks in the United States, he can't actually give the real names because that's a violation of the Agent Identities Protection Act, so-called Valerie Plame Act.
But, you know, if our Attorney General, Eric Holder, had the same principles as this Italian prosecutor, they'd be prosecuting Rummy and all the rest of them for torture crimes.
No, it's a fantastic case, this Italian case. One of the CIA agents has already lost his house in Italy, gone, obviously some combination of the case and a divorce or something, but he can't go to Italy anymore to visit his house, one, because it's not there, and secondly, because he'll be slapped in prison. So it is having some effect, and we'll see as we go forward with whether there'll be other cases. The one in Spain is still pending in front of Judge Garzon for various Guantanamo torture. We'll give you updates on that as soon as we have some more results on that. It's still going on, and they haven't made it to final part of the case where they're going to decide to go forward or not. They're waiting on the United States. But this is exciting news in Italy.
Michael, we covered several weeks ago the Goldstone report on the war crimes committed principally by the Israelis, but also by the Palestinians, but principally by the Israelis, who slaughtered some 1,400 people in Gaza, including almost 300 children. And there was this terrific report that Judge Goldstone wrote. Give us an update on what's happening with that in the United Nations.
Well, what happens with the Goldstone report, it gets taken to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, where a report is made about what Judge Goldstone found. That report is done in part by the rapporteur, Richard Falk, who we've had on our program. And the big question is, what was the UN Human Rights Council going to do with it? But even more, what was going to be the United States' position about that? And the United States put forth its position through a new Assistant Secretary of State Michael Posner, who's the Assistant Secretary of State for, I think it's called Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and his job is to protect human rights. And Michael Posner used to be the head of Human Rights First. Well, you can go online and read Michael's full talk at that UN Human Rights Council. It's only a page, but it's quite extraordinary, because here we have Richard Goldstein, probably one of the two or three most eminent jurists in the world. This was the man who was on the Constitutional Court of South Africa. He was the special prosecutor, I think, for the tribunals in the former Yugoslavia. I mean, this guy is it. I mean, he's up there. He's a Zionist. He was someone who said, I'm going to look at both Palestinian and Israeli violations of the laws of war. He came out with his 652-page report that utterly condemned particularly Israel for deliberate targeting of civilians and on and on. And so the U.S. response was, the U.S. was going to be in difficulty because here you have this most respected and eminent jurist. So, well, how does Posner begin? He basically says, quote, we believe that the document, referring to the Goldstone Report, is deeply flawed and disagree sharply with its methodology and many of its recommendations, including their extraordinary broad scope. So here you have Michael Posner, former head of Human Rights First, and the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, talking about Judge Goldstone, one of the most eminent jurists, and his report as saying it's deeply flawed. And essentially, by the push of the United States, the Goldstone Report got taken off the agenda at the Human Rights Council.
Yeah.
So it's just a complete outrage, but just another action in the way the U.S. has been acting all along, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, whether it's human rights advocates or others. Here you have the secretary in charge of human rights saying, let's get rid of this thing.
Posner's acting as a lawyer for the far-right Israeli government, pure and simple. And it's really a disgrace for him to try to
I wouldn't necessarily say that, Michael. He's not just acting for the far-right Israeli government. He's acting for the United States government.
Yeah, who covers for the far-right Israeli government.
So there you go. I mean, what else can you say? But this whole issue is an outrage. A second issue has come up with regard to Israel this week that we should at least mention. In talking about international justice, and of course we just spoke about the case against the 26 CIA agents, as you know, there's various cases around the world trying to get both Bush and Cheney and those guys, and trying to get some of the Israelis who were responsible for Gaza, some of the Israeli generals. And this is an earlier case that concerned a bombing in 2002 in Gaza. It's a former military chief named Moshe Yalon who is responsible for dropping a half-a-ton bomb in Gaza, killing 14 civilians along with supposedly one militant. The Center for Constitutional Rights has had a case against Yalon, which we lost. This happened in 2002, the bombing. But recently, the Israeli minister refused to go to the United Kingdom because he feared arrest. He feared arrest in the UK and he refused to go. So we're beginning to have some effect on these guys, whether it's the CIA agents going to Italy, or whether it's going to be John Yoo not wanting to go to Spain, or the Israelis, and this is the second Israeli who's refused to get off the plane in England, fearing that he might be arrested in the United Kingdom. So let's keep going, guys. Elliot Madison, a social worker and activist, was arrested in Pittsburgh last month during the G20 summit. He was charged with hindering apprehension or prosecution, criminal use of a communications facility, and possession of instruments of a crime. The Pennsylvania State Police claim he was found in a hotel room with police scanners and computers while using the social networking site Twitter to communicate police movements to the protesters at the G20. Madison recently said, quote, they arrested me for doing the same thing everybody else was doing, which was perfectly legal. It was crucial for people to have the information we were sending. Mr. Madison's lawyer, Martin Stoller, said, there's absolutely nothing that he's done that should subject him to any criminal liability. Attorney Marty Stoller joins us today.
Okay. Marty, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you, Heidi, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you and Michael.
Many of us were literally shocked to read in the newspaper and hear about the arrest of longtime activist Elliot Madison for effectively twittering and communicating to protesters about police movements at the G20.
That's what it looks like. The complaint that was filed against him in a county court outside of Pittsburgh where he was arrested indicates that he hindered or obstructed justice by passing on a message that said the police had issued an order to disperse. Now, how that fits under the definition of hindering prosecution is beyond me.
Seems it's helping out the police in a way, right, Marty?
Exactly right. Here, the police said, disperse from here, don't go there. So that's helping out the cops. I don't see how it's hindering them. But in any event, they selected him out of all of the people who were posting things at the G20 on various Twitter boards and got a search warrant for his motel room, rousted him and a colleague of his who were there, arrested him, and Elliot was held on $30,000 bail. Even though he's married, owns a real property, he's got no prior record. I mean, he meets all the criteria for bail, but they decided that $30,000 would be appropriate. Fortunately, he was released. Unfortunately, a week later, agents of the FBI and the Joint Terrorist Task Force showed up at his home in Queens with a search warrant that was issued by the federal court in Brooklyn, seeking evidence of violations of the federal anti-rioting laws. Think about the Chicago 8.
I can't believe it. You know, I was wondering when I read the newspaper about this, and of course that's where I saw that you were representing him. I said, what's the federal violation here? And of course they weren't clear, and now you're telling us it's the so-called Rap Brown Act, right?
That's exactly right.
Named after Rap Brown, as a colloquially, as the anti-riot law, which is, as you said, a Chicago 7 case.
Yeah. And they spent 16 hours searching his home, grabbing everything in sight. And it's, you know, it's just terribly unclear what could be evidence of violations of the federal anti-rioting law. So they took pictures of Lenin, pictures of Marx, anarchist literature, fiction and nonfiction writing that Elliot had done, property belonging to other people who lived in the house, folks who were producing a documentary film, another guy who was producing a weekly radio show, a third resident who had a computer that she was using that was given to her by the federal government for a project that she was hired on, all sorts of things.
Let me ask you a technical question here. They go to the door with a warrant. The warrant, I guess, specifies what they're allowed to take. But what you're saying is they not only took Elliot's materials, they seem to have taken everything in the house. I don't understand how that could be.
It seems fairly clear to me that they conceived of the house as one residence, and they didn't conceive of the fact that there might be other people living there. And they came with a warrant, which is on its face a valid warrant, properly issued by a magistrate judge in Brooklyn, at least properly issued until I can see the affidavits that underlie the warrant and make some claim about them. But they were just sort of willy-nilly grabbing everything in sight.
I think you went to court to try and stop the search at some point in the middle of the search or afterwards. What happened?
No, the search ended about 10 o'clock on Thursday night, having commenced at about 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I figured I'll do something. And so Friday morning I whipped up some legal papers, which included an order to show cause and a motion under Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure Rule 41G, which is a motion for the return of property that is illegally seized. The judge on Friday afternoon gave me a temporary restraining order saying to the government, leave this stuff alone. Don't search it. Don't analyze it. Don't index it until I can figure out whether Mr. Stoller's application to appoint a special master who would review all of the materials that were seized by the FBI can make a determination. So the FBI's ability to look through all the boxes and computers that they seized on Thursday is on hold, at least until next Friday, October 16th, when we appear again before Judge Irizarry in the Federal District Court in Brooklyn to see what she's going to do about my motion for the appointment of a special master and the return of various items that have absolutely nothing to do with the subject of the search.
Now, Marty, we've seen this time and time again where the police target known activists, and they may call them leaders, for example. Is it possible that Elliot has been on their radar since the RNC?
My guess is that Elliot has been on their radar, and that's the only explanation that I can offer as to why he, out of everybody else who was posting things on Twitter during the G20, was arrested. And the weird thing is that he's posting stuff, or he's accused of posting stuff, that is publicly available. That is, a police scanner, which is up on the internet, says an order to disperse has been issued at such and such a location. That piece of public information is then passed on to somebody who's signing into the Twitter board to see what's going on. And that's what constitutes the crime that he's charged with.
So let me just say, if I went on the computer
this point at the G20, and I went to, there's some site that has police scanners on it. I could just look at that police scanner and send out Twitters about what the police scanner says. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Not only would it be in writing, but it would be oral.
So when we say, or when it was alleged that he was found in a hotel room with a police scanner and computers, he wasn't actually found with a police scanner. So I don't know what he was found with, if anything, but it would be a computer.
Well, there was definitely a computer in the room. The complaint says there was also a police scanner. What the complaint does not say is that the scanner was never used, because it wasn't necessary, because apparently police and emergency service responders post their messages up on the Internet that anybody can chime in for.
Marty, this is very similar to the so-called Shack 7 case in New Jersey, where seven activists ran a website and posted just names of protests around the country that were happening. And they were all charged and convicted on, I believe, sort of interstate racketeering charges. And
yes.
It reminds me of that.
It's something that's a reminder, although what they were posting was not publicly available information.
Ah.
They were creating the information, and I suspect that there was a little more than just where demonstrations took place. But their arrest and conviction and the heavy sentences that they got is really an attack on those activists. Here in Elliott's case, it's not quite the same thing, because he's transmitting public information. It's as if, let's say you and I are in the middle of a lawful demonstration, we're walking together, and I point down a street and say, look, don't go down there, because that's where the police have issued an order to disperse. Well, is my speech giving you that information now criminal? That's essentially what Elliott is charged with.
Now, it seems to me, as I said earlier, you could argue that that's a way of saying, really enforcing the police order, that don't, you know, disperse, so you're not going to go where they say you shouldn't be.
That will certainly be my argument, Michael. I mean, what is annoying in the larger sense here is that Smokey, which is his nickname, and his wife and some of his friends have been longtime legal supporters, paralegal supporters of people involved in demonstration activity. And what they are now doing, apparently, is targeting the people who provide support services for people who are involved in otherwise lawful demonstrations. That's a little scary.
Yeah, no, it's very scary, Marty. Let me ask you, so Elliott had a $30,000 bail put on him in Pittsburgh, and I guess he posted, whatever, a bond or something for that. Is that right?
Yes, bail was posted, and he was released the next day.
Does he have a charge in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, there are three charges. One is the hindering prosecution charge. The second is the unlawful use of telecommunications devices, namely the computer and the cell phone, I guess. And the third is possession of criminal instruments. Again,
the same.
Computer and the cell phone. There are three charges. Two of them are felonies. One is a misdemeanor. We've done some preliminary research into Pennsylvania law. There is absolutely nothing that's even close to a case like this for hindering prosecution, for possession of telecommunications instruments and criminal instruments and things like that. This is an absolute first and a real stretch of the criminal law to penalize what is essentially speech, and it's First Amendment protected speech as far as I'm concerned.
It's remarkable. Now, the federal case, and there isn't, I guess, a federal case yet, there was a search warrant issued pursuant to a possible violation of the Anti-Riot Act, but there's been no charges yet against Elliott for that. Is that right?
That's correct. And there are two possibilities with that search warrant. One is that it is directly connected to the Pittsburgh arrest, and it's an effort by the federal authorities here in New York to assist the prosecution in Pittsburgh.
Right. Get them evidence here if they can find.
On the other hand, and this is something I always have to be wary of, there's a possibility that there's a separate investigation in which Elliott is potentially a target. So I have to be very careful about what's coming on down the road. Essentially, like you've talked about with Shaq, and here, you know, Elliott and his associates could well be targeted as defendants in a nationwide case, people who are assisting people who are engaged in lawful political activity. I mean, let me say another thing about Twitter and something that has been pointed out to me. The so-called Green Revolution in Iran after the debauched elections there and in other places around the world, the people who are demonstrating have been using Twitter in exactly the same way that the folks at the G20 used it. When the repressive governments came down on the people for using Twitter and for demonstrating, our State Department said, hey, wait a minute, there's free speech issues here. You can't punish people for posting things up on a Twitter board. And then we turn around and we get Elliott's arrest for doing exactly the same thing.
Let me ask you about the law, at least, that they're looking at in New York, the federal, the anti-riot statute, what we call the Rap Brown statute. Remind me what that does. It says that people who cross state lines for the purpose of rioting, or what
yes,
does it do?
Crossing state lines for the purpose of inciting a riot. And it's a violation of the 18 United States Code.
And that was passed, of course, I guess in the 70s or 60s? 70s.
Oh, definitely in the
60s.
It was in the 60s.
Of course, it had to be.
It was used for the Chicago 8,
yes.
The folks who were indicted for what was the police riot in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention in August of 1968.
And it was really done to discourage, put a lid on, and repress demonstrations and go after their leaders, which is what happened in Chicago. So what you're saying is that could be what they're thinking here.
It could be. It's a possibility I have to consider as Elliott's lawyer. It's something as a human being I hope is not in the offing, but being the paranoid criminal defense lawyer that I am, I have to keep an open mind here.
Marty, you know, a side effect of this going after Smokey is that it sends a really chilling effect to other activists around the country. I mean, this is just terrifying, and I suppose that's intended.
I mean, the Twitter stuff is terrifying, I have to say.
It's terrifying. It's chilling. It says if criminalizing protesters and suggesting that protesters somehow are the equivalent of terrorists is one thing. But now criminalizing the folks who provide support for people who are involved in lawful demonstrations takes it to another level and attempts to cut off dissent in this country in ways that I certainly did not expect the Obama administration to be countenancing.
Marty, how is Smokey doing?
He's doing okay. You know, he's a little bit shook up, as you would be after being rudely arrested for nonsense and then for being woken up at 6 in the morning a week later and having all of your personal property and private documents subject to a law enforcement search. You know, but he's come through it. One of the interesting things, a little sidelight, is that in the course of the search, they claimed that they found some fireworks in the house. And so they took Smokey out, took him to a police station, and issued him a summons for the New York violation of illegal possession of fireworks.
Unbelievable.
So we got another case pending, too. That's a returnable out in the Queens Summons Court. And I can't wait to get out there to have the summons court listen and decide my motion to controvert a search warrant that was issued by a federal court.
This is going to be it. Marty, this case looks like it's going to spiral for a while, but really, good luck with it next week. I mean, this is really, the idea that you can Twitter and go have your entire house searched, I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Big stuff.
Yeah, it is. You know, I'm doing everything I can to try to get Smokey out of it and to try to set some precedents. I hope that this is the last time that this is going to be used.
Let's hope so. Well, thank you again, Martin Stoller.
Smokey's in good hands, Marty. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Heidi. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We have the power! I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses, newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the graces shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear.
In November, the Supreme Court will address the constitutionality of sentencing a child to life in prison without the possibility of parole. There are two main cases being argued. One involves Joe Sullivan, who at the time was a mentally disabled 13-year-old child living in a home where he was subjected to physical and sexual abuse. He was convinced by others to partake in a burglary of a home, where the elderly homeowner was sexually abused, although she didn't see her attacker. Joe was tried in adult court, found guilty, and sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole. Sent to an adult prison at the age of 14, he was abused and later diagnosed with MS. To talk about the issues at hand, we're joined now by Stephen Harper, adjunct professor of juvenile justice at the University of Miami School of Law. Stephen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this month the Supreme Court is going to take up the issue of whether it's constitutional to sentence a child to life imprisonment without parole for offenses that they committed when they were teenagers. Can you tell us a bit about the cases?
Well, there are two cases. One is Sullivan, who was 13 at the time of the crime, and the other is Graham, who was committed a crime when he was 15 and then came back into court when he was 17. He did not get convicted the second time, this is Graham, but he did get his probation violated, and they were both sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Those are the two cases that the court's going to look at in about a month's time.
Now, I know we have covered this on our show before. Roughly how many juveniles are in prison, or really how many people are in prison that are serving life without parole?
Life without the possibility of parole. Well, it's interesting because it's if you break it down in terms of cases, which both of these cases are, life without the possibility of parole for crimes that were not homicide crimes. Neither of these kids committed crimes that were homicides. So most of the people on prison for, there are about 2,400 kids in the United States, but only about 120 of those kids did not commit homicide. So there are about 120 kids with non-homicide cases serving life without the possibility of parole in the United States.
And the remainder are ones who were convicted of homicides, and those are serving life without parole, 20.
Right, and those cases, that issue, at least as we know it, is not before the court. The court obviously took two non-death penalty cases and non-death cases, rather, and they're going to look at those cases and make a decision.
Stephen, you know, obviously these kids are not angels, and obviously they're also really messed up with all kinds of horrible histories when they were growing up. But what's the rationale? Why would a government want to keep a person who committed a crime when they were a young child in prison for life? What do they say about this? Does this happen in any other advanced countries like America?
Interesting you ask me that, because the United States is the only country in the world that kids sentences children to life without the possibility of parole, because I think every other government and most people would understand that sentencing someone of that age who is still, in terms of culpability, very much less culpable than adults, and certainly has a much better opportunity to rehabilitate and to still grow. And so across the world, it's non-existent. The United States is the only country that sentences children to life without the possibility of parole.
And in that context, you're considering both kids who have been convicted of murder or lesser crimes. No other country gives them life without parole, you're saying.
That's correct. Now, another thing, though, that needs to be said here is that part of this was an accident. In other words, there were, in the adult system, they were getting tougher in the early 80s and 90s, particularly the early 90s, and they were starting to sentence people to life without the possibility of parole, while at the same time they started to transfer more and more kids into the adult system, in part because the juvenile system punishment jurisdiction, meaning when the court has to give up its jurisdiction over the child, ends at 21 in most jurisdictions. So that a lot of kids were getting transferred into the adult system so that if they got convicted of a crime, there would be more jurisdiction over them for a longer period of time. So a lot of kids in Florida, for example, got transferred into the adult system And they got convicted of murder or second-degree murder, and all of a sudden it was available to the judge to sentence them without possibility of parole, although it is not clear at all that that was the actual intent of the legislature. It was sort of an accident.
The facts in the case of Joe Sullivan revealed that he was mentally disabled and also then developed MS. I see in one of the photos he's in a wheelchair now.
Right.
Did the court at the trial level take into consideration his mental disability?
No, none of that was raised, and it was not considered at all. The court in that case did a very sort of perfunctory, that's it, this is a terrible crime, goodbye forever. And it was only later that lawyers like Brian Stevenson, et cetera, began to really investigate and find out other factors that should have been brought to the court's attention at the time of sentencing. And that's the other thing. I mean, what we're dealing with here is a situation where other things happen in a person's life. They could become rehabilitated. They could become a better person. And there should be some opportunity, argue Brian Stevenson, that they have an opportunity. It's not to say they're going to be granted parole. It's not going to say they're going to get parole. It's not going to say it's going to happen tomorrow. But they have some opportunity at one point in their lives to go back to court or go back to a probation office or go back to a parole office and say, wait a minute, I have changed. I'm a different person now. And to have that board consider that and make a decision whether to release him or not.
We're talking with Stephen Harper, adjunct professor of juvenile justice at the University of Miami Law School. Stephen, what states are the worst offenders in the country when it comes to putting children in prison for life without parole?
Well, Florida is the number one state. I mean, Florida by far and away has the most kids on life without the possibility of parole. Florida compared to the rest of the nation, there was a study done by Professor Paolo Anino at Florida State University, and he found that there were, I think, two-thirds, if I recall it correctly, of the kids serving life without the possibility of parole are, in fact, in Florida.
Wow. Let me ask you about the possible outcomes in these cases. Are they saying that you simply can't imprison a juvenile for a crime committed as a juvenile to a life sentence without parole? That they're obviously saying in the cases. But are they also arguing that a life sentence for a non-murder committed by a juvenile shouldn't even get a life sentence with or without parole? I'm asking which they're really pushing here.
No, they're actually only challenging the life without the possibility of parole. It's a very limited challenge, and the court could only give very limited relief, which is, okay, if you are sentenced to life with a possibility of parole, at some point, someday, somehow, under some mechanism, a state has to give you some possibility of relief. And that's really not a very big thing that the court would be asked to do, give them an opportunity. And that's really all they can ask for.
We're wondering how Justice Thomas is going to get around this one.
This one, I mean, I think there's obviously a fair chance of winning, but of course, as you're saying, it's a limited victory because, as we know, the parole system, at least in certain states, I don't know what it's like in Florida, is really a rubber stamp for keeping people in prison year after year after year.
Well, and that's something I don't think either side can really address. But, you know, this case really comes down to death is different, say the states. And the other side is saying kids are much more different than that. In other words, death is different. That's what Roper versus Simmons is all about. And we treat people on death row differently than we treat non-death row cases. And the court has historically given great deference to states when it comes to other kinds of sentencing.
What's Roper? What's Roper?
Roper versus Simmons is the case where the Supreme Court abolished the death penalty for juveniles. And that was a death case. And so what the advocates in this case are saying is, wait a minute, kids are kids, and kids are much more different than we ever knew. And the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric and Psychological Associations agree with that in their amicus briefs. The question really comes down to, kids are much more different, or, as the states say, well, wait a minute, that analysis is only reserved for death penalty cases. In non-death penalty cases, we have a much greater latitude to sentence however we want to sentence.
But doesn't Roper really say generally for young kids, teenagers, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, that their minds are not formed yet and that therefore wouldn't that position taken by at least a number of the justices in the Supreme Court apply to all kinds of crimes committed by juveniles?
Well, that is the question really before the court, as to whether they would extend that analysis to non-death cases or whether it's specific to death penalty cases and only death penalty cases, I think it clearly, and this is my opinion, applies to kids, because kids are different in all the ways that we know and all the ways science continues to tell us, and that is far more important than it's a death case or not a death case. That seems to be a false distinction when you're dealing with the idea of how grown-up kids are or are not.
When do you expect argument in the case?
Argument is set for November 9th.
So we could have a result by spring then?
Yeah. I mean, they have to decide by June before they...
Right. Well, we're chipping away very slowly, but we're chipping away, I guess.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it really remains to be seen. It's an interesting case because they took two cases. They kept them separate. That has a lot of people scratching their heads. Why did they do that? Whether... And if they get rid of juvenile LWOP, it remains to be seen.
We are hoping to have you back on in the spring so that we can discuss the Supreme Court decision.
Be happy to come back.
I fully expect you're going to win. I really do. It's just such an outrageous practice. But you're right. Why did they separate the cases? That one throws me.
Well, if outrage was a measure of justice in this country, it would be a lot different, Michael.
I know. It's just so shocking to me. But anyway, anybody who has kids out there, anybody who doesn't have kids, knows what a 13-year-old is like. So,
Stephen, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Many listeners have probably seen the videos of the G20 protesters going up against hundreds of riot police in Pittsburgh. Some of the most compelling footage was of the reckless use of LRAD, long-range acoustic device, the sonic weapon, and the huge surge of riot police onto the University of Pittsburgh campus. Many students who were not protesting were rounded up, knocked down, tear-gassed, and beaten by police. We reported last month on the blatant violations of First Amendment rights as local police, likely guided by the national police, engaged in patterns of harassment of activists such as the group Seeds for Peace. Today, we hear firsthand accounts of police abuse from our own Heidi Boghossian, who was there marching with the demonstrators and observing as a legal observer for the National Lawyers Guild. And she will be joined by New York City Attorney Joel Kupferman, who is also a legal observer with the National Lawyers Guild at the G20 summit.
Joel and Heidi, I know you were both out as lawyers, I guess legal observers of sorts, at Pittsburgh for the G20. Joel, what were you doing out there?
Legal observing and also giving training to Pittsburgh law students to be trained as legal observers.
And Heidi? What were you doing?
I was there to help make sure our legal observers were deployed in the appropriate places, but also to observe and document the general trends of police escalation of violence against protesters.
Okay, Heidi, why don't I start with you with the general trends, and then I want to talk to Joel a bit about the University of Pittsburgh.
What we saw in Pittsburgh was the addition of the long-range acoustic device, LRADs, which have been used in Iraq. And we believe for the first time we're now used against civilians in the United States. I was standing right next to the machine, which was mounted on a large military truck. It emitted a series of annoyingly high-pitched shrieks. And at the same time, the police were often giving a pre-recorded order to disperse that they played over and over again, so that with the combination of the shrill shriek going over and over, you had this recorder device. It was literally like being in the middle of a militarized zone.
And how many people were standing out there or protesting?
There were several hundred. At that point, there had been a march from Arsenal Park, and people started going down different side streets. But they were, I would say, at least 400 to 500 there.
Now, Joel, were you at that scene as well?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, we were on the other side. There was a big police line. And Heidi and I became separated, and I was there with a group of legal observers.
And what's the effect of that noise? Did you have a sense of it? I mean, could you hear it?
Well, I instructed all the legal observer interns to watch with their eyes, and this time it was their ears that were the main witness. It was almost debilitating. It pierces the brain. And I saw most people, including myself, just grab our ears to try to block that sound.
And did it cause people to run away from where they were?
Some people ran away, and some people were almost stupefied that they couldn't run. It just puts you in a really bad place.
And this is the first time they've used LRAD in an American demonstration in the U.S., I guess. Right,
but as I understand it, some reports have come out that it was here during the Republican National Convention, but they just didn't utilize it.
Wow. And has there been any legal action taken against LRAD? Do we think it's a legal means of doing anything?
Well, we think it's illegal. We think it's an invasion. We think it's a weapon. As a matter of fact, one of the legal angles that we're looking into is the Fifth Amendment, that we charged after 9/11, we charged Christy Todd Whitman with violating our Fifth Amendment rights or invading bodily integrity. And in this case, we believe that sound definitely pierced that bodily integrity. And as a matter of fact, the manufacturer of the device filed in their Securities and Exchange Commission filing in September 2008 that the device is capable of sufficient acoustic output to cause damage to human hearings or human health, expressing concern that its misuse could lead to lawsuits. So the manufacturer itself, you know, slipped this into their SEC hearing.
Heidi?
I think it's important to note that what we've seen over at least the last decade in the United States is gratuitous assault against protesters at large mass assemblies. And we've seen an increasing range of so-called less lethal munitions used against individuals who may be just standing there lawfully trying to express their viewpoints. The LRADs are the latest piece of equipment that has been added to that. It's worth mentioning that many independent review panels over the last decade have come out and said that these techniques against protesters and bystanders are violating many of the legally binding international human rights treaties that the United States has ratified and thus become part of U.S. law. In addition, they violate standards set out in the United Nations Code of Conduct for Law Enforcement Officials, which states that force should be used only where strictly necessary and in proportion to the threat posed. I think the lesson here is that excessive use of force is being used in situations where it need not be used. And in many cases, the appearance of legions of police in riot gear, the National Guard, police from all different, I think we counted over 20.
Including Arizona sent their contingent.
Exactly. From different police forces and different levels, many of which were also private security officers being used.
Do we know what company they were from?
We don't know what company. We saw it on a university campus as well. And I think Joel was right there late one Thursday night. Joel, what did you see?
University of Pittsburgh. Is that where you were,
University
Joel?
Of Pittsburgh, right. Yes. We saw some fighting going on the perimeter.
You mean fighting between protesters and police?
Between protesters and police. And the police started lobbying their gas. And the Secret Service was specifically stating that it wasn't tear gas, but another form of gas. It's supposedly less lethal, but it was definitely I and many journalists reported, and they told me that their eyes were tearing. It was painful. But the scary part of that whole incident is that they basically like went up the hill onto the campus, and students were just coming out of their dorms, hearing this noise, hearing the helicopter, you know, sounds, and didn't know they should leave their buildings or stay in their buildings. And they just started arresting people who had nothing to do with the protest. They weren't protesters. A lot of the students didn't even know protest was going on.
Let me ask you about the protest for a second. So this protest is taking place on University of Pittsburgh campus. Is that right?
It was on the perimeter. I mean, in some ways, it was on the perimeter facing where a lot of the G20 people were meeting.
And how many protesters were out there, do you think?
40, 50 or 60. And a lot more police. I've never seen, this is the highest police ratio with the protester I've ever seen.
You mean like hundreds of police?
Thousands.
Thousands. Thousands of police at just this University of Pittsburgh.
Yes. There was just lined up. And as a matter of fact, they just lined up around two or three of the parks, arm to arm. And it was.
And you said there were people coming out of their classes and
The classes out of the dorms. This was in the evening. And they just started arresting people one after another. Some people they let go, but it was definitely, I think, a radicalizing experience for a lot of those students. But it was just, there was no cause. There was no cause for arrest for these students.
And police were doing things like swinging their batons at passersby. I know one woman I ran into the next day say she'd been clubbed and was just trying to get to her apartment building. It's worth noting that we saw the most police violence on Thursday and Friday nights. We actually weren't there for Friday night, but we heard, I think there were over 80 arrests, and someone texted me on my phone and said the police just went wild here. I don't know whether they thought they could get away with it more at night.
But it's sort of a harbinger for those massive arrests. They arrested legal observers. There was someone that I trained.
Is that
I was
right?
with for
wow.
2-3 hours, walked across the road to the other side, and with no provocation, they came. They basically forced them down to the ground. And then they did that with the journalists. This, you know, the, I think it's they didn't get journalists on this, you know, on their side this time, but they basically just wantonly just arresting people, you know, in a violent fashion. There was a way of just pushing. I never saw so much force in terms of forcing people down to the ground.
And one of the things that I'd like to mention, because we've seen this at protest over protest, including the so-called national special security events, of which this was one, we see vilification of protesters in the media for months leading up to the event. A few of us went out to have a very late dinner one night before the big protest started, and all the local merchants in the downtown area were pretty much closed. Most of them were closed for Thursday and Friday. But when we spoke to local shop owners, there was a hatred that I have never seen before in how they talked about protesters. And we even, when we walked into a few stores, were looked at as though we were aliens. And I think it's because they might have thought we were protesters, but there was a hatred. And I watched some of the local newscasts during, I think, Thursday. And the newscasters were not impartial at all. They were talking about violent protesters, shrugging their shoulders and saying, you know, they couldn't wait till it was all over. It was a very biased mass media agenda that I think is helping to perpetuate negative feelings about First Amendment.
And of course, Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania had turned down all the permits, and that's we covered a few weeks ago when we had to go to court to even get a right to march.
But the sympathy that I heard from people in neighborhoods were in the neighborhoods of color, and it was amazing that they basically
that's
said that there was this was escalated, but they were used to police presence.
Yes, that's true. We went, I think, Wednesday night. We had legal observers at a late night spontaneous protest that went from the downtown area out into the surrounding neighborhoods. It was really nice because as we were marching out, a lot of people in cars were honking in support. And yes, there were local bar owners of color were coming out and lending support. So I think what Joel said is absolutely true.
I want to get some perspective from both of you. First of all, how massive were these demonstrations? Were there lots of demonstrations in Pittsburgh? Were there lots of people? Were there lots of different places?
They were spread out. And part of the problem that we had in sort of getting legal observers everywhere because we didn't have cars was that they might take place downtown, but mostly through the surrounding neighborhoods. And they were miles apart. So that in a few instances, especially after the Arsenal Park, and I think on Friday night, there were thousands of people assembled. Often, though, there were masses of hundreds in different locations around the neighborhoods.
And both of you have covered lots of demonstrations over the last few years, I know that. Do you see an acceleration in terms of what the police are doing, the kind of police, the kind of tactics they're doing, Joel?
It was a climate of fear, and that's what they try to instill, and basically saying you can't assemble, almost like for any reason. You were just guilty of if there was like 5-6 people gathering together, there'd be a police presence and people asking. And I think that was the upsetting part to me. That it, and also the multitude of the jurisdictions that were there. And the
yeah, that's interesting. Heidi mentioned that, but tell us a little more about that.
It almost seemed like it was a police convention. I mean, these people, they volunteered, to do this work. And the scary part also was that you saw a lot of not even the National Guard, the Pittsburgh Police Department wearing army fatigues, you know, and that was just more than physical. It was psychological to just instill this fear in people that they should not gather and they should not protest peacefully or not peacefully, you know.
I can imagine, you know, when you say police convention, that probably a call goes out to departments all over the country, state police departments, private security. Everybody comes to Pittsburgh and they sort of get trained and they have a little party and they put down protest. I mean, that's what it sounds like.
But it was interesting. A few days after, I got a call from a law enforcement person that's outside the jurisdiction saying that he was really concerned about the LRAD. You know,
the LRAD being, say it again, the acronym.
The long-range acoustical device. That there was concern that there was going to be harm not only to the protesters and people in the community, including children and vulnerable people, but even to the police officers themselves. And I have experience with that.
That's good.
After 9/11, that working for the Firefighters Union and doing work even on behalf of the PBA, I spoke to some of those cops. And I think some of them were, you know, a little scared and realized that the police aren't there to actually back them up if they, you know, that I heard. And also what's interesting that a pretty high inspector in New York City Police Department was there at basically every demonstration leading the cops. When he retired, he asked for disability for loss of hearing, you know, from the demonstration. So, you know, I think there's proof on New York NYPD's books that sound demonstrations can cause harm.
Let's talk about the aftermath at the G20. Are there still people in jail? Are there still people facing charges? Are there going to be any kind of civil suits?
I've heard that a lot of the charges have been dropped, but I do know there are individuals that have court dates coming up. I don't know the exact number. I'm sure there will be civil suits. The Guild is planning to do, and Joel will be helping with this, an after report that will include a discussion of the long-range acoustic devices.
We want to look into that this was used as an experiment or model, and we're really concerned that I think why all those diverse myriad of police departments were there was to learn from the Pittsburgh Police Department. And some of them said it worked. And it's really scary. And if they're saying this experiment worked, the Guild is definitely has its job cut out that it's not just Pittsburgh that we got to be ready to deal with communities across the country. I think it was the hypocrisy in some ways that the G20 picked Pittsburgh as this green city. And they said it's a green city, that it was a lot of parks down there, and they did some, you know, some beautification. But I also just want to point out that a lot of people also pointed out that it became green at a default, that they basically let American jobs go, you know, down the drain. And the sound alone does not make a green city. So I think Pittsburgh, you know, did not, you know, put that welcome out for anyone else but the G20 leaders.
Heidi, any last thoughts?
The one thing I'd like to add that we didn't mention is that I saw more canine units there than I have at any other demonstration. In many cases, the animals wore leather muzzles, but in many cases, the police pulled them off.
Wow, that's pretty amazing to me, seeing dogs down there. Joe, did you see that as well?
We saw a lot of dogs, especially going down to one of the Guild conventions down in Alabama, seeing the Selmer Bridge. It brought back a lot of memories, and I think those dogs are there to intimidate a special segment of those who are protesting.
Right. I mean, of course, they use them at Guantanamo. They use them in Selma. And now, of course, they've come to Pittsburgh.
Many, many vans labeled canine units were going through all the time.
This is serious stuff. Well, thank you both for being there, not only G20, but probably every demonstration we have in the country. So thank you, Joel.
Thanks,
thank
Michael.
You,
Heidi.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.